Well, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon with you, Dawn, I will say. But perhaps we could start by your giving us, the recorder, your name, and describing, you didn't work in the grain industry direct. So anyway, perhaps you give me your name first, and then we can get into...
I'm Dawn McKee.
Let me ask you, you said before we began recording that you were born in Gilbert Plains, Manitoba, then you made a reference to something in the back 40. Did you grow up in Manitoba on the farm?
Oh, no, my dad was a railroader.
Okay.
And he was a telegraph operator. He came right after the first war. He had his arm blown off in the war. So this was a job he could handle. Yeah. But he, at that time, in the steam days back then, of course, there was every 100 miles there was a telegraph operator to relay messages, etc. And he lived everywhere from here, Gilbert Plains, up the north line towards Sulicote, several different places, you know, little stations. Right. That, and of course, I was born in Gilbert Plains,
yes.
And then we moved to Thunder Bay and right. Fort William at the time.
And so when you say Sioux Lookout, this means he was working for the CNR.
Oh, yes. Oh,
right.
Yes. Yeah.
And,
absolutely. I was the only railroad around.
Yeah. And so you settled here in Thunder Bay, working here in, Fort William back in those days?
We came here, I'm not quite sure. It was probably prior to my birth, around sometime in the early 30s. And of course, I was born here, and I pretty much lived here all my life. We did, the wife and I, we did live in Winnipeg for a while. We lived in Sulicote for a while, but most of the time we've been living in Thunder Bay, you know.
At what age did you begin working for the CNR?
I joined the railroad. I came out of high school, and I went to, always wanted to be a diesel mechanic, and I went to Cam Motors as an automobile mechanic. I spent a year there or so. And then, of course, being the son of a railroader, I was pretty much guaranteed a job on the railroad if I ever wanted it, you know. So I took my apprenticeship out in 1953.
At the railway?
On the railroad, CN, yeah.
Yep.
And then started over in the Port Arthur roundhouse, which I don't know if you were, there was a roundhouse in Port Arthur.
Where was that roundhouse?
That was located just north of the ore dock.
Okay.
Between the CPR tracks and
Northern Wood.
Northern Wood.
Later.
In between those two, there was a roundhouse in there. And there was a rip track. A rip track is just another term for use for a repair track for. Mm-hmm. For all the equipment other than locomotives were repaired. So right. I started there in 53.
Sure.
Transferred over to Niebing here in 54. Spent a couple of years at Niebing and then moved out to Winnipeg in 56, Joan, I think it was. Yeah, 56 as an apprentice and spent... I spent 23 months in Winnipeg, and why the odd number was because if I'd have been able to stay there 24 months, I could claim my seniority in Winnipeg, and they didn't want any outsiders coming in there and staying there, you know.
So management shifted.
Right back to Niebing, yeah.
Right.
The day I finished my apprenticeship, I was laid off, so that's when I went up to Sulicote.
Okay.
And...
working for the railway
working,
there?
Oh, yeah. I was working for the railroad, and at that time, you know, here comes a young kid coming up to a small town, and I'm going to put somebody out of work because I'm exercising my seniority, you know. I was pretty kind of uptight about that, you know.
Yeah.
But it turned out fine. The guy that I replaced, I pushed him back onto a day job. So he didn't mind that all that much either.
No, I dare say.
And we spent about... should I tell him the story, Joe? About...
Leaving me at the depot?
Yeah, I left my wife at the depot with the baby. At that time, they used to have we called it the local, but it was north, a train coming from Niebing, or Fort William, up to... Sulicote.
The old Superior Junction line.
Yeah. And, of course, it never, ever arrived on time. So that one day when she was coming, I said, I'll slip across the street, I'll have a beer. Train's never on time. And geez, I get out there and I says, oh, I better go over and see if the train's in. And this is probably half an hour after it. And the train had arrived. And so I guess it was a CM police directing my wife how to get to where we were living. Yeah, I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't in the good books.
No,
that's for sure. But we spent...
No, early in a marriage when these things will happen.
Yes.
Later
yeah,
on,
yeah,
it was better. Yeah. Yeah, I went almost stood my wife up at the Toronto subway.
Yeah. Yeah, so we stayed there about November to the following July, I think it was. And we got called back to Nebing here and came back again and worked for 2 years, 1 or 2 years, and got laid off again. And then I went out on the highway as a welding, out in Trans-Canada Highway working for a contractor.
Right, because the Trans-Canada was still under
control. Oh, yeah.
About 1960-61, I guess.
This was, because this was just west of Ignace, and we were building a stretch of the Trans-Canada Highway in there.
Sure.
And I was a welder out there.
Right.
Stayed there for a while and ended up I quit there and came back here and got hired back on the railroad again. So, and then I was on the railroad.
From that point
from
on,
that
around
point
1960,
on, yeah.
61, for the rest, till your retirement.
Until I retired in 91.
In 91, so about 30 years then, unbroken with the earlier service here.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned welding when you, in this last period away, that had been part of your training earlier, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, that was part of my apprenticeship.
Part of the apprenticeship.
Oh, yeah, you know, I had to learn how to electric weld and gas weld, you know.
Sure, on whatever you were
repairing. Whatever you were doing, yeah.
The work that you did, were there different kinds of things you did, let's say, after 61? Unless you want to glance back.
Well, actually, you should go back further than that, because I started out, like I said before, that I wanted to be a diesel mechanic.
Right.
Well, the first day I went on the job, I went to the machinist there, and he took me down to a steam engine, and we had to grind in a throttle valve, which I knew absolutely nothing about. I didn't know nothing about a steam engine or steam locomotives or anything, you know. And I had to help him grind this throttle valve, and I was just ready to quit that day, you know.
He was testing you?
That was before diesels were actually being used on the railroad.
How long did the steam locomotives remain in service?
They remained until 58.
58.
By 1958, pretty much all the steam engines were gone, you know.
And what drew you to the diesel locomotive if they weren't common yet? When you in high school, if you had this dream of being a diesel
mechanic? I wasn't considering diesel locomotives. I was thinking of diesel trucks.
Diesel engines.
Yeah, diesel engines we're going to be used on. It didn't matter. But
so in a sense, it was your father's being with the railway that had you think the diesel would end up being diesel.
Oh, yeah. I actually thought when I started the railroad, I would definitely be right on diesels right now, you know.
Yeah.
When I spent half my apprenticeship working on steam locomotives. and then, of course, by that time, they were changing over here at Nebing, and we all had to go to school and change the course of our education from steam to diesel.
What made the diesel engine interesting for you?
I was always interested in mechanics.
Sure.
I took mechanical course in high school, automotives, you know, and it was just an interest I had in
it's a different kind of engine, isn't it? My father.
Oh yeah.
My father was quite mechanical and repaired his own machines, rebuilt an old Model D. The old two-lunger John Deere tractor and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so and then later on he had a Fords and Major diesel engine.
Yeah.
And so I have some sense of these different engines. So that's why I'm curious about what drew you to the diesel engine. No spark plugs, compression fuels the fuel and so on and so forth?
A fuel air mixture with high compression, you know, that high compression creates heat. And that's what ignited the diesel fuel, you know. When we did that changeover, it was kind of funny that the senior machinists at the roundhouse here when the diesels first came, they were issued white overalls because they thought these diesel locomotives had to be squeaky clean, you know. And they'd be on working on things for half an hour and they come out, they're just as black as when you worked on a steam locomotive. They were no cleaner whatsoever, you know. And only the most senior machinists would be allowed to work on diesel locomotives. The others all worked on steam, you know.
Yeah.
So every once in a while they'd send an apprentice, now you can go down and work in the diesel shop today, you know.
Sure.
And that's what you're looking for.
Right. Yeah, my father, Ford's a major, had a Perkins diesel engine out of England. Yeah.
I worked on Perkins engine.
And the, am I right that you had to get the nozzles re-gauged every once in a while, and you could screw them out of the engine and take the nozzles? He'd take them into Winnipeg. We lived about 50 miles out. I'd take them into Winnipeg to the business where I think it was probably an English machinist or whatever there to clean or whatever to make sure they were the right sizes, these nozzles which injected the fuel into into the cylinder. Anyway, here we are with the the real guts of the machine. In your working, did you work on locomotives mostly, or was it
always
after 61? It was locomotives all the way.
Our diesels all the way through after that. You know,
how large a crew was there working on the diesel engines? How many diesels did you have to be?
Well, when they first came in full numbers, in the Nebing roundhouse was assigned, 10 road locomotives, diesel locomotives, and we had 17 diesel yard engines assigned to Nebing roundhouse for maintenance.
27
in all. And we did almost all. We didn't remove diesel locomotive engines because we didn't have heavy duty enough equipment, but we did almost everything else, you know. And we started with that. We had at that time there was about around 100 employees working at the roundhouse at the time.
On the locomotives or on other things?
On all aspects of the locomotive. When I'm talking the roundhouse, that was strictly locomotive.
Was it?
That was strictly locomotives. The repair track was down for them. They looked after all the other equipment.
Stock.
Yeah, all the other rolling stock, right. Yeah. But we had all these engines assigned to us, and that took up a lot of time because you did maintenance work every day, and we had what we called mileage tests to do, and they were pages long of things that we had to do.
Locomotive would come in, and you would work it over from one end to the other,
right, from one end to the other,
everything else.
Yeah, everything, the whole works. And then besides that, we did the repairs that were required, like changing out wheels and stuff like that. Believe it or not, those wheels, they wore out pretty quick, you know.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah.
Wearing out from the friction?
From going around corners.
Oh, really?
On the tracks. Because you know, if you notice how the wheel has a lip on it.
Right. Yeah.
And, of course, every time you go around, and the way the wheels were designed, people are not probably never aware of it, but if you get a pair of wheels, turn them both and power both of them, they would still turn at the same RPM. So one would be trying to slower, and one would trying to go faster to get around the corner.
Yes.
Well, that's what wheels did. Were so designed that they were sloped. They were actually sloped like this, you know. And when you went around the corner, the one side would be higher up in the rail and would ride higher on the wheel, and the lower one would ride lower on the wheel, and it would act like a differential.
Right.
So one would be actually recovering less ground, going the same thing, but covering less ground on one side than the other, you know.
Because these locomotives were direct drive from the engine, well, not direct, but via transmissions from the engine.
No.
Or were they electric?
They were totally electric.
So it should have been possible to have, well, later, perhaps computer control, so the one wheel would run a little slower than the other on a turn.
No.
Why not?
Because it has an 8-inch steel axle, goes from one side to the other. Nothing.
So it's a single axle.
It's a single axle.
One engine is driving, or one electric engine.
Well,
it
drives one pair of wheels. Yeah.
Of course, I'm talking about an engine on each of the wheels.
Yeah, there is.
That it could have been. Yeah, done.
If there was the newer ones have six traction motors, they're called, each driving a pair of wheels.
The still, diesel, still a pair though.
Oh yeah.
On the axle.
One on each side. Oh,
yeah, they're centrally mounted then.
Oh yeah, the traction motor is sitting right in the middle of the of the axle, and it was gear driven.
Right.
And
I guess that's the problem. The transmission is probably the problem. The fact of the gearing down from the engine and so on.
Well, it's quite a bit involved as far as there is kind of a like a transmission effect. Was if you run the engines in parallel and then you run them in series, that would be just like shifting from low gear to high gear, you know, for the power the traction motor is getting from the engine itself just drove nowadays it's an alternator, mm-hmm. but when I was on, they're called main generators, and they stood about 5 foot in diameter, the main generator, and you'd have a 16-cylinder engine, and that's what it did.
Sure.
It drove that and developed the electrical power for most of ours at that time were four-wheel trucks, and mm-hmm. And they would drive the four traction motors in.
So diesel locomotive, in a sense, is
diesel electric.
Is an electrical electric locomotive, yeah. Except that you're using diesel to generate there rather than feeding it in across the tower.
Yeah.
Do you have any knowledge of solely electric locomotives?
Oh yeah, there was, but we, of course, never had them here. But there was with the wires.
Yes, overhead
wires.
There are places where that would happen.
Back in 19, I think the first all-electric locomotive was in 1948, came out in 1948.
Now, the interurbans, Ontario Hydro was experimenting with running trains out into the country in the 1920s. There was a real struggle in North America between the possibility of railway interurbans or the automobile, and so on. In that context, they must have had a small electric locomotives, which would be streetcars.
With overhead.
If you will, expanded. But the diesel locomotive, I guess, which may have used some of that same technology, of course, is as the big diesel, 16-cylinder diesel engine.
Yeah.
Who made the diesel engine?
Well, we all had General Motors.
These were all General
here,
Motors.
But there were other companies.
Fairbanks
Morris and Alco, which is American Locomotive Company. And,
right. General Motors was building them in London, Ontario, was it? I think.
I don't remember where they were built.
I know we lived in Nelson for 9 years, and Nelson was notable in Canada for having old Fairbanks Morse locomotives. And people would travel across the continent to come to Nelson to get pictures of these Fairbanks Morse.
Never liked working on them. They were just.
You have worked on some.
Oh, yeah, we had a couple here. They were.
Yard machines?
No, road engines.
Oh, really?
And they were. Eight cylinder opposed pistons, which, and that's in effect, they're this way though.
Oh, up and down.
Up and down. They had a crankshaft at the top and a crankshaft at the bottom.
Right.
And they were a big, big brute, heavy. Everything was hard to work on them.
How high from crankshaft to crankshaft?
The engine itself would be from here.
Well, I was thinking of crankshaft to crankshaft. Would it be? 6 or 8, 6 feet or something?
Do you mean?
Well, from the crankshaft through the...
Like I said, the pistons would meet in the middle here, about here.
Right.
And the crankshaft would be there, and the upper crankshaft was up there.
A good 6 feet.
I would say close to that.
I was just wondering if there was any advantage in having them run up and down rather than sideways.
Ask the manufacturers.
Actually, I guess if you had them running sideways, you would have the effect of gravity pulling them down, whereas this way, it was sort of gravity-free, I guess. Except for the pull.
Well, yeah.
Yes. In any case, you didn't care for
them. When we got rid of those two locomotives, everybody was happy.
Did the CNR then was experimenting a bit with locomotives? If you had a couple of those, I assume.
Oh yeah, yeah. They
and
of course
came around to the General Motors one.
They bought from the three different companies at that time.
All three.
The Alco was the American Locomotive Company. Yeah. Our yard engines were Alco for a while, and then they switched over to General Motors. The General Motors is just an all-around perfect engine. You know,
high quality.
A lot easier to work on than the others.
And so in terms of the shop where you were, the efficiency of repair and maintenance and all the rest of it would argue for one system and the best kind you had, which was the General Motors.
Sure.
Right.
And we were, you're virtually geared up to maintain that. yes. type of locomotive, you know.
How many changes in model occurred over the years that you were working?
Oh, they went for years. Well, of course, there was the A and B units. Those were the enclosed units. You never, they were just same as the one down at the Cam River there, at the CPR station. Okay. That's an A and a B unit down there.
Okay.
They were totally enclosed, and everything you worked on, you did it from the inside. And then they went to the, we called them Jeeps, but they were general purpose units. And then, of course, you worked on it from the outside, opened up all the doors, and there was the engine, you know. And then it went from there to the, those were around for years and years and years and years. And then they came up with what they have nowadays, which is still in all the same. You know, you opened up all the doors, and you worked at them. I know there's one thing, people always wondered why CN units on their Jeeps, the GP9 units always had the cab at the rear of the unit, and the CPRs always run theirs at the front of the unit. And that was, it was a manufacturing process to have the cab at the front. But the CN and the unions decided that they have that long nose in front with a lot more protection in the event of an accident, that they would have that in front of them rather than just going plowing right into it with a cab, whatever you had, if you had a head on.
Sure. Now that was surely true.
That was
you,
fun.
In your 30 years plus in the industry, do you remember many collisions?
We had collisions on the shop track.
Well, that's slow speed though.
Oh yeah, they're slow speed. I was never in, you know, I've been out to wrecks where there were engines all laying all over the ground and the rest of the train, but I personally was never in an engine when it happened.
But there were collisions so that the CN system may have saved some lives that is against the...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know that, and I don't know if that was ever proved, actually, you know.
But you understood that the unions negotiated this with CN management.
That was the fact, yeah.
Yeah. And so these are sort of three different kinds of locomotives that you were involved with over those years.
Yeah.
In doing the work. And let me see. When did you start working? How long did you work there? Who did you work for? What kind of work did you do? We've been working through those questions just in pursuing this and getting detail. Would it make sense for you to describe a typical day on the job?
Oh, yeah.
Lots of typical days, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There were lots of days when you do doing these mileage tests, got to be. So routine, they got monotonous, you know, so you always like to run into something different, you know.
Sure.
But anyways, you go to work. We worked 8 to 4 or 4 to 12 midnight.
8-hour shifts, including a meal break.
And you got 20 minutes for lunch. And, of course, we got paid right through. You didn't lose any time for lunch, you know. And you'd get your assignment in the morning. You go to it, and if it was possible, you'd finish up by day's end. Usually, first thing in the morning, when I was working day shift, you'd get the yard engines in from the night shift and get them into the shop right away and do the maintenance on them. They used to go through a lot of brake shoes, steel brake shoes, you know. They'd go through thousands and thousands. I've changed thousands and thousands of them.
This is on the yard?
On the yard. Yeah,
because of the stopping, starting, and all that.
Constant stopping and going. You know.
Yes.
So we'd get those ready first thing, you know, get them out on time, and then you just do your regular daily routine. Mm-hmm. Whether you're changing out wheels or doing mileage tests or changing out air compressors or whatever, you know.
Right. And every once in a while you'd have more challenging work when you really...
You'd get, you know, it happened on much more than one occasion that in the wintertime for the engine freezing up. And once it froze, once the water wasn't antifreeze or anything, it was called chromate. It just had a chromate chemical in the water to prevent corrosion. You know, that was the big thing. But if they quit on the road or whatever, and the engineer would go out and turn one valve and figure you're draining the whole thing, and you didn't always get it all, and of course it'd come in and be froze solid.
Pipes were broken.
You just hated to see that one come through. Then you figure you got them all fit, and you fill it up with water again. Here or there and everything.
Yeah, that's one easy way of testing whether it's waterproof. But
that's how you test it. After you figure you got them all, you pump the water to it and see what happens. You know?
Remember the ore dock?
Yeah, I'll get to that.
So the this would be widger work when someone had made a mistake.
Yeah. And then sometimes they'd run out of water and they'd keep the engine running. Or for whatever reason, you know, they had shutdowns on them, but it didn't always work, I guess, because they would fry the seals in the, like in a GM, you take a power assembly. That's one piston, piston rod, cylinder, cylinder head, all as one unit. And then you'd lift them out, and they all had seals around them. So,
so the engine had separate units.
There were
like
16.
There was not a block.
Nope.
I see.
Not on the GM, no.
No.
There were 16 individual units you could change out, which was excellent.
Facilitated repair. Oh, yeah. One of the strengths of the locomotive.
You could, if you threw a rod in one, it just, that was just that one assembly was gone, and you'd pull that out.
You would drop it in.
Put it in.
Overhead winches.
Yeah. We had overhead cranes.
I see. So the repair of engines would be a lot. So I was thinking of, you know, where would be the big shop? CN's shop would be Montreal.
Transcona.
Oh, Transcona.
Yeah. That was the big shop.
Yeah, of course. It
for was Western Canada.
It was a Western railway out of the Grand Trunk and the Intercolonial.
And it they did everything there. You know?
I see. Still do, I suppose.
Not time. So much. Edmonton's got it all now. It's moved out to Edmonton. Yeah. My son, he works in Winnipeg on the railroad, and he says there's not much really going on in Transcona anymore.
I see.
Ship it all out west, no time at
it. When you mentioned these problems with locomotives, their engine drivers are responsible for these problems, aren't there? The railways were distinguished by having a number of unions representing the various workers. Yeah. You would belong to which union?
The IAM, the International Association of
Machinists. IAM, right.
And later? And aerospace workers.
And aerospace workers, right.
Got a kick out of that.
Shoot. Up in the air. Now, and then there were, of course, all the other unions.
All the other locomotive engineers, electricians, car knockers, and then, of course, there was all the trees involved with passenger service at that time, that time.
Porters, the conductors.
Yeah, and conductors.
And so on and so forth. The running trades.
Yeah, the running trades, They were the elite.
Yes, indeed.
So they running trades. I said, you wouldn't go 2 feet if we didn't fix them.
What were relations like between the various groups of workers and their unions?
Like I say, with the hoggers, they thought they were the number one, eh?
The running trades.
Yeah, the engineers, you know, they thought they were there, and they could do no wrong, almost, you know. And
until they ran one dry.
Yeah, or whatever, you know. And then they'd be complaining, well, why did this engine break down, or, you know.
You had to repair it, right?
But, they thought they were top of the heap, you know.
Were the encounters of this sort mostly sort of on the street, casually, or were there meetings of the various bargaining units together? Did you have those at all?
Well, we used to bargain with the electricians.
Because they were also in the
They were in the shop. And
were
and
there just the two groups?
No, there was the Brotherhood of all the laborers and guys that worked in the storage department and the office staffs were another unit. I forget what they were called now.
Oh, so the laborers, the office people, so were in one union.
Yeah, well, not one union. They bargained together.
Okay.
While the engineers, conductors, and they were.
So there was a kind of Brotherhood of Railway Employees.
Yeah,
in the 30s. Was that it?
Brotherhood of Railroad Employees.
Yeah, was that Mosher's Union back in the middle of the years of the century?
I don't know.
Anyway, we don't need to pursue that too long. Were there, so you were saying, now would you bargain at this, were contracts concluding at the same time?
No. The hoggers, the engineers, they generally settled first. And what they got, all the other ones kind of feed off.
They were the price setters in a sense.
That's right, yeah.
In their negotiations.
Yeah.
But But the contracts might still be ending at the same time. Or the
not new, necessarily. No? Not necessarily.
So they might negotiate 1st of January, whatever. Yeah. Three or 4 months later.
Exactly.
You'd be guided by that.
By what their decision.
You weren't working, the big strike about 1953 took place.
Oh, yeah.
Were you working there?
Yeah, I started in 53.
Okay, at the time, or just after the strike, or was it? I'm a little hazy because as to when exactly
was, there
the
strike was a strike after that. That had to be after the.
Because there's a big strike.
I started in October of 53.
There's a big strike that precipitated some of the shifting of freight to the highways, to trucks, as I've heard it, in terms of the development of the industry or transportation in Canada. There were, of course, later stoppages as well, I'm sure, strikes and lockouts.
We never had a long.
Never had one, eh? Never.
7 days and we were ordered back to work by the government.
Oh, yeah, well. A Crown Corporation. It happened every time.
Every time.
So the calculations were made in those
years. Yeah, you're working on accordingly.
Right. And were there social gatherings of all? Well, of course, you could hardly guess. You sit at the same table with the Hodders, I'm sure. Eh?
Oh, sure you would.
Oh, you would.
Oh,
eh?
Yeah, there was. Oh, yeah. Because they'd like to, they'd come back and try and tell you how some of the systems on the locomotives work and kind of just sit back and, okay, sure. That kind of a thing.
So there was
they weren't telling us something we didn't already know. You know.
So there was a certain amount of camaraderie in its various ways for CN.
Yeah.
What about the CP, CPR?
We didn't have I shouldn't say that. That's not true. I was going to say, we didn't have a lot to do with the CPR,
That's what I was wondering.
Just because they weren't working in our area.
Right.
Like they were in their own
system.
House, and they had their own system.
Yes.
But eventually, we kind of got together with the CPR as far as curling goes.
Okay.
We started a curling back in 55, somewhere around there, and we were looking for some curlers, and CPR was looking for some curlers, so we formed the CNCP Curling League, and it went on. Till today.
It still goes on.
It's down to four rinks, mind you, but curled every Thursday morning.
Where do you curl?
Fort William Curling Club.
Fort William Curling Club. Great.
Been there all the time. And I curled there for about 30 years, and my knees gave out on me, and that was the end of that, you know.
Yeah.
But it's still going today.
What about a credit union shared as well, or not?
No, the CN had their own credit union. I don't know what they have nowadays because there's no CN employees anymore. Like when I said,
we'll
before.
Talk about changes later on.
Okay,
that's one of them, quite clearly.
Right, but we had that league for years, and that's where the CN and CPIs,
sure.
CPR guys got
chiefly
together.
At the curling, all Canadian activity
after curling.
Oh yes, thank God for the after curling. Okay, so what you did? Who did you interact with? What tools and equipment did you use? Well, maybe distinctive equipment in the shops.
Oh yeah, we had like changing out wheels involved huge drop tables. You take a traction motor and a pair of wheels would weigh in somewhere around 10,000 pounds. You know, so you had to have a table. You put the locomotive over the table and you unhook the traction motor and wheels and drop them down, move them over to the track next to it, lift them back up. Roll them off and then roll new ones on.
This is partly the structure of the building.
Of the building, yeah.
The shops involved a number of lines, rail lines, through on which machines could sit.
Oh,
how many bay eggs?
The roundhouse was 24 pits. The diesel shop occupied 6, and the others were for the steam locomotives. And once the steam locomotives were gone, well, they were used for storage and
sure.
Anything else that was required, you know.
Is the roundhouse still a...
No.
It's gone?
Oh, yeah, it's long gone. I took pictures of it in various stages of...
Demolition,
right from when it was all there. I went up on the roof and took a picture looking down and to see how it looks like, you know, what a roundhouse looks like. And then right from when the last wall came down.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in terms of changes. I'm just... This happened after you... After you retired,
the final.
Because there were always diesel locomotives to be worked on here as long as you work.
As long as we were there, yes. So
what happens now? They're done in Edmonton.
They're done. It's all done there now. All they got here is One machine is now to check when the train comes, check the oil and water, and that's about it.
You know. I see. The locomotives that shunt the grain cars and the elevators and so on, are those road locomotives?
Yeah, they are. No, yeah. They are pretty much. Well, the 1900s are still yard engines per se, but they do your, and you know they're remote controlled.
Are they the changes we can talk about? We will. What would you like people to know about the work you did in the, well, there's one place you worked primarily, if we ignore Sioux Lookout and so on and so forth. What would they, you think, interest people about what you were doing?
I don't know. Of course, I'm working with railroaders, so that's was the interest, eh?
Yes. What might surprise people about the work that you did? Describing about the repair of an engine, the fact that there are the several units and so on and so forth, I think that's interesting for people, but there are probably other things as well.
Well, I kind of thought that people always thought the railroad was an engine and a train.
Yeah.
And nobody gives thought to what keeps these things running on, you know. Of course, the engineer.
The general public doesn't.
Really. Yeah, the general public, they you know, they see a train and they, there's no thought in gone into what kept them going. You know? But, that's about what, that was my impression.
Yes. A couple of historians, I think they were at York at the time, York University, suggested that people tended to think of railways as transportation organizations. Along the lines you're suggesting, there's a locomotive in front. It used to be, of course, the tender with the coal when it was a steam locomotive, and then, of course, all the cars, the rolling stock. But their observation about railways in operation was that one could think of them as well as being manufacturing organizations in days when they would conceivably build even the steam locomotives, but build rolling stock and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
That, in fact, there was a great deal of production done by a railway as another aspect of a successful...
Well, that was done way back, though.
Yes, way back. By this time, you were depending on GM locomotives or whatever, and so on and so forth.
I don't know who built the iron ore cars. I know the CN did, or... I don't remember.
There was at one time, and there may still be, a steel car manufacturing business in Hamilton. In fact, 100 years ago, building. And then, of course, CanCar was a combination of a number of car building facilities in the Maritimes and Montreal. Now, they began CanCar here before the Great War.
Yeah.
They envisaged it as a big facility to supply rolling stock to the prairies. But I don't know whether they did ore cars or... Later on, of course, the grain cars... Many of them, I think, out of Dominion Steel or Sydney Steel in Cape Breton Island. This was employment creating work, I think, for the federal government, building those grain cars. You weren't ever involved with the repair. Was there any rolling stock of that sort? Were the cars repaired here or not?
Oh, yeah. When they, like I said, when we had the repair track, they had a staff larger than all we had, and they had all their, their repairmen were called carmen, eh?
Sure.
And of course, we refer to them as Carnockers.
Who were the Carnockers?
Were these carmen repair? They that did all the repair on all the rolling stock, like such as iron ore or iron ore cars that came by, box cars. And there was box cars, you know, made of wood.
Yes.
You know, back then, before they all went to steel, and they would literally build all, you know, take the old lumber off and build a new box car, you know, and.
Sure. And this would be an example of the railway as a manufacturing.
Doing their work, Right.
Okay, so what might surprise people? What are you most proud of in the work that you did over the years?
That I was a pretty good mechanic. We used to have apprentices would come from Winnipeg for what they call their online training, you know. Instead of working in the big shop there, they go and see what the rest of the railroad, how it worked, you know. And I would get an apprentice. I always like to have an apprentice. I like to say, well, now, what you learned in Transcona, you forget about now because this is a whole different thing here, you know. And
was that completely true?
Oh, yeah.
In what ways is that true?
For one thing, you know, the apprentices would come down here and they would expect the heavy equipment change, like taking locomotives up from one tie overhead crane and moving them down to other ones and doing all this heavy work, extremely heavy work. But to change out a brake shoe, they had no clue how to do that, you know.
So Transcona had equipment to
do
that kind of heavy stuff.
I was most impressed. First day I walked in at Transcona back shop, I walked in there as an apprentice and I looked up and here's a steam locomotive being lifted up way up in there and then moved down about 200 feet further down in the shop and then laid back down again. And I just, I couldn't believe that something could be lifted.
That's machinery.
that was machinery.
Right.
But they came
down. What you were saying about the detailed work.
I enjoyed teaching them about, in fact, just naming parts of a diesel locomotive, you know. Like every part had a name and then explaining the theory of how the air compressors worked and how the diesel locomotive engine theory worked and how the air systems works and all that, you know. And I was kind of like that, like doing that, you know.
Do you get a sense that maybe they would send them here for this kind of fine-tuning in their training?
Oh, yeah.
Because Transcona, surely, they needed that kind of knowledge.
It was a whole different type of knowledge in Transcona than what was here, you know. They actually see how the locomotive actually worked on a daily basis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, they got pretty good training here, I'd say. Yeah.
I guess I'm still curious. What was happening at Transcona for those kinds of machines? There must have been people doing similar work there, though. It came right down.
Well,
or not?
No.
Were the road locomotives rather ending up at the Fort William shop?
No. It wasn't that. It was the fact that when you went to the back shops, Transcona. When I went there, the steam engines were still being done in Transcona.
Right,
the diesels were being done in Fort Rouge, which is another part of Winnipeg.
Right, South Winnipeg, off Osprey.
And when I went to Transcona, you had, with steam locomotives, the machinists there made virtually everything for a steam locomotive. They made it.
Manufacturing.
And machined it and molded it and the whole works, you know, and they did all that kind of work.
Well, you're going to kick me if I say they really deserve the name of the union, International Association of Machinists.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were really the machinists there, you know.
Yeah.
We had a small machine shop at Neving, which, of course, when the steam engines were there,
we did work.
Did machine work, you know. Yeah. But once the diesels came in, it wasn't make, it would replace, you know.
And so when the diesels came in on the prairies, this Fort Rouge shop was probably enlarged, or it would even have been built for
they did eventually, once the steam engines left Transcona, they moved Fort Rouge over to Transcona.
Okay.
And utilized all the facilities.
I lived in Fort Rouge as a university student, 61 through 64,
oh, yeah.
So which would have been the time when those Fort Rouge shops were in operation, I imagine.
Yeah. I lived in Fort Rouge for a while, we did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always close to work, you know.
Yes, very convenient indeed, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you certainly have every reason to be proud of keeping those locomotives operating.
Oh, yeah, we...
How close to the elevators and the grain trade would this have brought you? Would it be as close as the fact that the grain didn't move if the locomotives weren't pulling it? Or did you get closer to it than that at any time?
I'll have to say that... We never concerned ourselves with the grain trade.
You just didn't think of it.
Didn't enter into our train of thought anywhere along the line, because we get trained. The foreman would say, "All right, we've got just as a figure, say we've got 10 trains ordered to go. Got to be out at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whatever." Yeah.
Yes.
And that's what we had to work for. Don't be laid off the shop track because there's a train out there waiting to go, you know.
Right.
And everything is geared to time, eh?
Right. And the fact that locomotive, this would be a yard locomotive, I suppose you're talking about.
Not necessarily. We'd have reworking on the engines that actually pulled the train.
The reason why that locomotive was needed to be rolling out.
Oh, yeah.
Just didn't arise
as
a consideration.
You didn't want to be late.
No,
there was the phones were ringing right away. Where's that locomotive?
Yeah.
let's get going here. We got crews waiting to take it out, you know.
Sure. And it wasn't your concern where the crews were going to take it or what they were going to do.
We couldn't care. The ore trains seemed to be back in those days were a big thing in town.
These are iron ore from Steep Rock?
Steep Rock, yeah.
Or from the Attica. There was more than one Attica.
Oh, yeah, there was Kalin, Steep Rock, and I forget the name of the other company that was there. But that was a big thing, ore trains, you know.
Did you have some kind of sense at the shops then that keeping the locomotives operating on the ore was
that was important. Number one, as far as you know, that was number one.
I mean, the grade was just sort of incidental.
That was there. You know.
Now, the locomotives, of course, were involved also in moving package freight, passenger cars, and so forth, and there was more of the business.
We had, I remember here back in the steam days still, remember the Royal American shows that used to, circus had to come here? Well, we used to have to get the locomotive ready. The steam locomotive, to pull that train out of town. And I'll tell you, that thing had to shine. And the way you shined up a steam locomotive, you take oil and wipe oil all over it. You paint the wheels white, you know. And it
well,
had
that it weighed coveralls, of course.
Oh, yes. And that train had to really sparkle, that engine, you know, when they pulled out the Royal American shows train. The circus train.
So how far would that locomotive pull it? To Sault Ste. Marie?
It would go
the next site
would? Go up to Winnipeg.
Or to Winnipeg.
Probably be the next place that it would go. That would be the next place.
And
then
they'd clean it off once again.
Well, they'd do one, they'd do it all over again. Yeah.
I wonder if the Royal American shows paid extra for the...
I don't know.
To what extent...
I would imagine they did.
To what extent were you conscious of competition between the two railway companies and for business? Did that reach down to your level or not?
Well, no. No, it didn't really. We always thought we were a little better than CPR, but they thought the opposite. So
I suppose they did.
You know? And
what went into the sense of CN superiority?
Well, I think because it was a Canadian-owned railroad.
They both were, but...
The CPR was privately owned.
Of course.
You could buy shares into the CPR. Yeah. You could not buy shares in the CN.
No, it was a Crown Corporation.
It was a Crown Corporation, and just to be part of a Crown Corporation just seemed to be the steadiest thing in the world at that time. Yeah. You know?
And I guess for a long time it was.
We'll talk about changes,
I guess, because that was among the things that changed later on, I suppose. Yeah. There wasn't ever a sense by the 60s, shall we say, of how the CNR system actually got started, or was there? Was any kind of consciousness?
No, there was not. You know, like when I joined the railroad in 53, my brother joined the railroad prior to that, and of course my dad was in the railroad.
Yeah.
He joined the railroad, I think it was in 1920 or 21, 20. There's his watch. There's his railroad watch.
Oh, yeah. Now, did he talk about the beginning?
He never. I was 10 years old when he died, so, you know, we didn't really...
Yeah, unfortunately.
You know, I wouldn't know.
And talk to him as an adult. Yeah,
no way. You
know. Ask questions of that sort.
So, and even all the time that I worked, it rarely was it mentioned that the CN combined of several railroads.
Right. Did you ever hear of the Grand Trunk?
Or,
Colonial and so on?
And I probably learned more about that after I retired.
Right, you read some history.
Oh, yeah.
Because, of course, the Canadian National Railway system was designed for a number of purposes, but it combined... Ah, the library is here. I hadn't looked at the shelves. The Canadian National Railway system was created about 1920. Out of the bankruptcy of the Canadian Northern, the Grand Trunk Railway, the Grand Trunk Pacific, and of course the National Transcontinental Winnipeg to Moncton, I guess it was, existed as a government line, and the Intercolonial out there and so on. I think the cynic might say that it was designed to save the Canadian Bank of Commerce, which had loaned an awful lot of money to the railways, because the Canadian National Railway system started out with the burden of all of these bonds, this indebtedness put on the system. It was supposed to pay off the debts. A clean bankruptcy, of course, would have done it, as I say, the Bank of Commerce and so on. the government had taken them over at, you know, $1 per line or something, it would have been very different from taking over the bond, the indebtedness of the railway companies, which then...
And any money that was made was sent over to England to all the former owners of the railroads.
Well, yes, the bond, yeah. Many of the bonds... Yeah. It would have been held outside the country.
That's why we were in debt for so many years.
I mean, this is the ironic thing. The leading government line here is actually in debt to foreign. Well, it was in the Commonwealth, of course.
Well, yeah.
Fellow British subjects, sure, and all the rest of it. Let's not be too hard on. Yeah, it's an interesting history, that. But by the 60s, fortunately, or even the 50s, a lot of that was 30 years in the past and so on. The Great Depression was a different story, but we're not talking about that. So let me see... Do you think that the work you did contributed to Canada's success as an international grain trader? Well, you can't answer that.
I can't answer
in the
that.
In the simple way. But of course, if the trains hadn't been moving, the grain wouldn't have moved, and so in that sense, you were keeping the grain moving from the prairies to the elevators and so on and so forth. Was there any sense of the winter business when the lake froze over, when the navigation season ended? A certain amount of grain, some years, was moved by train.
By rail, right down.
Yeah, by rail. And so that would mean additional work, I guess, that wouldn't have happened otherwise, I guess. Were you conscious of that?
Yeah, we knew, like, once the port closed, that there would be grain shipped east by rail. There, of course, we didn't have nearly as many trains that went east, you know. It was wintertime in the prairies, too, you know. And
yes.
And even if the grain that was stored, you know, you could get rid of that eventually. And
yes. And I suppose from the prairies they could run it on the northern line for that matter.
Yeah, they could, yeah. But they ran it through here pretty much. You know what they did do, and I know this, is that they would bring a train of grain here, run it through the elevators, whether it was the middle of winter or not, to dry it, and then load it back up and ship it by rail. Mm-hmm. So there was a purpose of the elevators in the wintertime.
Sure. Kind of a hospital elevator function, if you want to call it that, in terms of the drying.
Because it had to be dry.
Right. Describe any connections you see between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain handle in the grain trade. I guess that's the other end of it, isn't
that's
it?
That's the other end, yeah.
It wouldn't have got from those country elevators to here again if the locomotives weren't doing
their job. Well, there was a lot involved in getting it.
Yeah. Well, the next section is on changes, and we've been... restraining ourselves a couple of times here. So what major changes did you see in your job and the railway business over the years?
Modernization of the railroad as far as locomotives go.
Because, of course, you saw the steam and then
to the diesel. They were, the you know, like steam engines were pretty inefficient. You know, a steam locomotive might be able to put out 25% of their horsepower to the track, you know. All the other rest of ours were running various things on the locomotive, while diesels were far more efficient to getting power to the rail, you know. Yeah. And that's the whole picture.
They were having to power the rest too, although the fact that these functions were now electrical, I suppose on the steam locomotive they wouldn't have been electric, things.
There were a lot of mechanical things. Right, run, you know.
And so that was one of the facts.
That was a big factor. The diesel locomotive would haul much more than a steam locomotive could. If you put it like one on one, backed them up together, the diesel locomotive would just pull the steam down the track, you know.
Did you ever see a competition of that sort?
No. Really? But they used to get ore trains. And they would start off with maybe one locomotive and see how many cars of ore it could pull. And then they'd add another locomotive and see how much it could pull. And they'd add another locomotive and see how much. And these were loaded ore cars at 125 or 130 tons each, you know. And they kept doing that in one period of time until the coupler started to pull apart, you know. And then, that's the limit.
Yeah.
We can't haul any more than that, you know. And that's and
did they then run you could trains put, with that many locomotives?
Yeah. Oh yeah, you could. When I was at it, there was a rule. Now I don't know who put the rule out, but you couldn't run more than three locomotives in tandem. you could put five or six of them together, but three of them had to be off power.
Right.
You couldn't put the...
deadheaded is the truth?
Well, no, 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 they weren't deadheading.
Now, what's deadheading?
Deadheading is taking a dead locomotive.
Okay.
A dead locomotive.
Like a car.
Yeah. Right. It's not running or anything. Right. But they would hook up maybe they had to just transport locomotives, and they'd put two extra, but they wouldn't shut them down. They'd run them, you know. And they wouldn't run more than three, because that's what the law.
Well, that's why I was wondering if... So they'd never have more than three on?
No.
Because that was the limit.
Not until more recent times, after the war. I guess they can run more units now.
Deregulation is allowed for
that. I suppose, yeah.
For good or ill.
Yeah.
Right.
I know my son told me that they run, you know, they run 2-mile-long trains now. And that's a lot of train.
It is indeed.
Yeah. And they, you know, if you ever had a train here 1 mile long, when I was working there, that was considered a long train.
Sure. Well, it is. And once the caboose is gone, I was in the house when that was under consideration. It seems to me that Ian Angus and I made some speeches on removing cabooses. Because we thought that was dangerous. So there were the technical changes then in the locomotives.
Oh, yeah.
What other changes do you remember?
Well, of course, like the maintenance of the centralization. Well, that was a big thing, too. Central Terminal Control, CTC. That was a big thing on the railroad. That's where I could, the people in the yard office, not in the mechanical department, the people that could run a train from Winnipeg to here and move all the switches by pushing a little button.
Right.
And they didn't need switchmen out there or anything, you know.
What kinds of electronics were they using? Were they... at what point did the telegraph lines no longer serve?
Ooh.
That's a long time ago, I guess, is it? So they went to what, radio then?
Oh, yeah, they went to radio, but radio...
could have its limitations.
That was fairly late, you know, radio. Right. Was back in probably 70, maybe in around there.
Are satellite link-ups used at home?
I don't know if they are.
You're not aware that they are. Because that would see, once the satellites were there, that would be... Yeah. I mean, a railway could afford to install the equipment on a locomotive and have the
signals. Well, they used to have towers. They had towers for the radios, you know, years ago.
As they would have to.
They figured they had about a 35-mile range for the radio. They'd have to have a tower up, you know.
And but, so they were controlling the switches at the at sidings by...
Yeah. All that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah.
And so you'd have a control room. It would have to be established with
there.
All the
just like
the
you see
where
it shows all the lights. And they had that. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And at some point, they didn't need an engine driver any longer.
That happened not all that long ago. In fact, you go over to the Neebing Yards here, I've seen it here. The guy's on the ground. And he's got the little control box here, and you move the engine forward, backward. Nobody's in the engine. And does all the yard switching.
Yes. What's the basic intention, would you say, of this kind of electrification, the radio controls?
Well, it does certainly save on staff, but I think it's just primarily it's just a more efficient way to run the railroad.
Reduction in workforce is an obvious reason for doing it, but you'd say the end result is more efficient?
Oh yes, it has to be. Yeah, the when I told you before that the we had 100-plus employees in the Neebing Roundhouse. Now there's one mechanic, one electrician, and a couple of laborers, and that's it. There is no more. There's no shop here anymore.
No. Do they do an adequate job, in your opinion?
All they do is just check the water. If there's something wrong with it, they'll shut it down and hook it onto another engine and haul it to Winnipeg.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
In the Transcoda shop?
Or
conceivably
or Symington.
Yes, that's right, the big, huge Symington facility you've got.
So that's what they do, you know.
Did you have any involvement with the development of the Symington Yard?
No.
I mean, in directing,
I've never been to the Symington Yard.
You got by it on the highway?
Yeah, my son works at Symington, or he still does. He still works out of Symington, and his job is basically the same type of work that a laborer did here years ago. They look after, supply the locomotive, fuel them, move them around to where they have to be, and so he's still doing that at a Symington now.
The Symington yards were built, what, in the early, mid-60s, as I remember. No?
Let me see.
Sorry. I read the description,
you might be right.
The hill is used to make up trains.
The hump
is that
yard,
Yeah, the hump. Is that mid-60s, it seems to me, somewhere. I was in Winnipeg 60 to 64, and then in graduate school, but back summer, 65, 66, I was back in Winnipeg. So it seems to me I read about it.
I thought it maybe was a little later.
Or was it later?
I thought it maybe, but I could be wrong on that, too. Yeah. You know, we had a hump yard here at Navy.
Did you?
Oh, yeah, there was a hump yard here, and the trains would come in, and they'd have the hump riders, and they'd ride down the hill, and they'd go into each track for each car, whatever track was supposed to go on.
Right.
And they had an old streetcar that would run down beside them, pick them all up, and bring them back to the top of the hill, and do it all over again.
Yeah.
That streetcar went down east to some railroad museum down there. But, there's been so many changes. Like now, everything's automatic, you know. You're talking about getting rid of the cabooses.
Yeah,
nobody believed that that would work, and they proved it wrong. It worked 100%.
Well, 95%.
Well, they're still using them, aren't they?
Well, it can be done, but there must be at least 1% of the time, or sometimes, when not having a conductor at the back or people in a caboose can create some challenges for the operation of the train. No?
I don't know. One time I thought that, but now they've been running for so long now they don't have any problems.
With few enough accidents.
I guess it's pretty near a foolproof system that they got.
The accidents happened in the Rockies, I guess.
Oh, yeah, well, that's not because of no conductors or in the tail end. That's just because too long a train.
Or what's happening in the locomotive at the front, I suppose.
And then they put locomotive in the middle of the train, and they're, literally what happens when they out there is when they go around the curve that there's so much power, and the trains are so long that the cars in the middle or anywhere, they get, when they start to go around, they stretch out so much that it lifts the wheels right up off the rails. And it's on the ground.
Yeah, right. Well, what impact did these changes have on your job and industry? Enormous reduction in employment, I guess, over the years.
Yeah, it was pretty good up until, the 80s. I know, like, my boy, he would get a job in the railroad, no problem at all. Anybody who was a railroader and had a family member, they would get it. But that went on for quite a while. And then, of course, the time came when they cut staff, you know.
So I would think of two or three things. If the grain trade declined as it did in the mid-80s and later, if there were, once upon a time, in the early 80s, 25 years ago, 1,800 grain handlers on the waterfront, and then it dropped down to 300, 150 working it, and so on and so forth, there have to be fewer trains. Some of that's automation, of course, too, but there are fewer trains running, so that's bound to impact somewhat. But then other things do kick in. There was a deliberate intention to reduce employment on the railways. Did some of that happen in the late 70s already?
Yep.
I have a memory.
Like when my, Kevin's been there 20, 21 or 22 years now. And
take him back to, that's 87.
Somewhere. And, you know, prior to that, you could get a job on the railroad, you know, but not, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know when they hired anybody like. You know,
and then when Mr. Tellier took over.
Yeah, he cut a few.
Seems to me there was one year when the railways cut thousands of jobs and shifted. For CN, it was still clearly a Crown corporation. It was shifting the cost from the transportation system to the UI system of the country when these guys all ended up. They're mostly...
Well, you have to realize that, you know, another huge change in the world when they got rid of the Express, CN Express.
The package freight.
The package freight now. And
when did that happen?
Well, roughly. That happened way back.
As far back as the 50s, conceived?
No, it would be later than that.
70s?
Somewhere 60s, and I would say where that first, and then, of course, they went to, CN Rail went to trucks.
Right.
You know, haul freight.
Diesel engines, I suppose.
You know, I saw here just the other day, and it amazes me when I see the CPR train going by here. You'd always ship a load of wheels on a flat car, you know, to go wherever they have to. Go down the highway and here's a transport hauling a load of wheels, CN or railroad wheels. Why? Why? I don't. They could just tack that on any old train that's going.
Sure. It's bound to be more expensive with the truck.
I would think so, but I don't.
It certainly ought to be.
Yeah, it certainly you would think so.
I was astonished to see in a supplement to one of the Toronto papers a little while ago, the assertion that railways were still carrying, I think it was something like 3/4 of the freight in Canada. Hmm. Now, I found that difficult to believe. Although, of course, if you're thinking of Crow's Nest Pass Coal, for example, or Saskatchewan Potash, or Prairie Grain, obviously there's an awful bulk there in terms of tonnage, but still, with all those trucks rolling, it seems difficult to believe.
Well, that's what they do, you know, they run these unit trains, just as you said, potash,
yes,
grain, whatever, you know, and they're unit trains, that's all they haul.
Sure. And I don't suppose you would have any comment on the change from the diversified trains, Express and all the rest of it.
That all happened after I was...
To these unit trains. I suppose there's a certain simplicity in running a unit train.
Oh, it is.
If you have a train that runs from, Sparwood or whatever the destination is in the Crow's Nest Pass to Roberts Bank on Georgia Strait, you just run sort of back and forth.
That's
there's
exactly
a certain simplicity to it, but life doesn't have to be simple. if you can make money with complicated things, you should.
they would run those trains, you know, with the same locomotives. Get to their destination, unhook the locomotive, go around the other and hook them up and go back.
Empty.
They'd go back empty.
Bring another load down.
Yeah.
Well, there were lots of changes to deal with at various times. What other challenges did you face?
Well, one I found really challenging was in 1985, computers came in on the railroad, you know, and at that time, I didn't know anything about computers, you know. And then a job came up there where they wanted a computer coder. The guy took the job and he didn't like it. I said, well, I want to get off the floor. I've done enough maintenance work put 30 years in that, you know. And I said, I'm going to just see what this is all about. So I went in the office and I said, you got anybody for me? He said, no. And they didn't have anybody that knew anything about it. So I said, I'd like to give it a shot. So I got, that was my first experience with computers. And I spent half my day talking to Winnipeg or Montreal, trying to find out.
What did you have sitting in front of you
in the way
of a computer?
Well, basically the same thing. You had a monitor and a computer and a
But it was what, IBM equipment tied in with a mainframe somewhere?
Oh, yeah, tied in with a mainframe in Winnipeg.
Okay.
And what my job was, every little thing, everything to do with maintenance on locomotives had to be coded in. And this was strictly for efficiency purposes. They wanted to know how efficient the shop was. So when I say everything, I mean if they had to have a guy to go from his work site to his toolbox to pick up a tool, that was, we had a book that was that thick of everything.
So you described step by step,
everything. And it was allotted a time.
Time motion studies.
Yeah. And that was done, and it was my job to code this in every day, you know.
Now, were you told what to type, or did you make it up yourself? Or?
Well, I'd have to I'd get the daily reports from the mechanics that worked. Right. They had to book everything off that they did, you know.
Sure.
So I have to collect all that, and then I input that. And
when you print it out, you've got the stuff of a man.
Yeah. But the thing is, it lasted for about 5 years, and then they realized that this isn't really a true reading. We had a shop out here, I made it 80% efficient.
How do you do that?
Just by not coding in something or not getting everything coded in, and or the time that it took or whatever, you know. And it was just, it became such a routine just to go to the computer, look at the sheets, or and put it in, and then should have been. And that wasn't just me. That was every place across the system did that.
It was really playing with it.
Oh, yeah, and they realized after 5 years that this
was 85 through 90, roughly.
We were just a great railroad, according to the figures. You know.
So, but, you may never have heard of Mr. Taylor.
Oh, yes.
You've heard of Taylor.
Brad Taylor.
Pardon me?
Brad Taylor.
No, this is a different, 100 years ago, there's a fellow named Taylor. Oh. Who developed this, and so we're historians will talk about Fordism, you know, Henry Ford, the idea of paying workers enough money to buy your product, and so on. Similarly, you get talks about a discussion of Taylorism, of this fellow with his time motion studies. One of the easiest ways to get at some of this is in a book on furniture making in it's The Gender of Breadwinners by Joy Parr in Hanover. She has some discussion about the weaving, the mills in Paris, Ontario, and then the other is on the furniture makers of Hanover. And it's very interesting because the Paris people there are women, many from the north country of England, Lancashire and so on, who were brought in to knit in the Penman's mills. And Hanover is largely German in origin, so you have these German furniture makers. And so she then discusses how these two places developed over the years, including the big Penman strike about 1947 or 8, I think it was. But in the Hanover case, there is discussion about the attempt to speed things up in the early 20s when, you know, Taylorism was applied to the place. And of course, it just caused an awful lot of trouble there as well. So this is kind of my background to what you're just, to my listening to what you were describing here in 85 to 90.
Yeah, so one day I went to work and I logged on the computer and I couldn't get in. I talked to my boss and he said, "Well, I'll phone him up." Well, didn't they tell you your job's been abolished?
And you retired the next year?
No, I had to wait 6 months.
Yeah. Oh, 6 months.
I said to the boss, I says, "Brad, I said, you know, I don't want to go back out on the floor." I was senior man in the shop, you know. I says, "I'm not going back out on the floor. I've been off it for 5 years. Don't even know what's going on out there anymore, you know." And he said, no, we'll look after you. He said, "But your number won't come up until," I learned that, I think it's in January. He said, "Your number won't come up until June or July," it was, "before your number will come up for retirement. So he said, "That's fine, man. I don't want to go back." He said, no, you can be a gopher. Here, go there, do that, do this. You know. So that's what I did for the last 6 months of my job.
And you didn't mind it too much?
I didn't mind it one bit. I was quite happy.
Now, so this change from being on the floor to working at a keyboard is quite a change.
Oh,
a lot of people in the community would think that you wouldn't have been able to hack that, I imagine.
You know, well, I didn't think I could handle it there for a while. I'm telling you, that job sure got to me after a while, you know, until I finally learned it, but I'd be coming home. I got numbers going through my head, right, left, and center, and phoning Montreal and phoning, "How do we do this? How do we do that?" And then, of course, after a couple of years or so I was doing that, I became the computer expert at NIMI. Yeah, sure. Nobody else was doing it, you know, so I became the expert. You're talking to the wrong guy here.
Head of the curve.
Well, that sounds like adaptability. My hat's off to you.
It was good for me, because like I said, I'd been on that floor for 5 years, and you're up to your elbows in dirt and grease and all, and heavy work. It was all heavy work.
Now, it did require a great deal of skill.
Oh, yes.
Mental acuity so on and so forth to do that. Yeah. But this other required all of that mental acuity plus stuff.
Yeah.
Would you, as another change, then you retired in 91, would you say that the 5 years working as a coder and all of that prepared you for retirement by any chance? When did you get your internet or email address?
I'll tell you, when I quit the railroad, I said to the wife, and I said, you know, I don't care if I ever see another computer the rest of my life. So I didn't. I said, I don't need a computer at home. Why do I need a computer? Well, my daughter started to get after me, and she was into that.
She wanted
my son. They were out. They're out of the family already, you know, or out of the house. So finally, I decided, maybe I should get a computer.
Because they wanted to be in touch with you. Oh yeah. Internet.
So I got one, and now, of course, I wouldn't be without it, eh? But it took a long time before I decided, might as well stay with it, you know.
Sure.
And I got my first computer, and of course, knowing nothing about computers whatsoever, I had 1 gigabyte of hard drive, and I thought that was, I'll never use that up, you know. You know what happens there.
What kind of computer did you buy?
At that time? I don't even remember. One of the popular ones.
A PC.
Yeah, it was a PC.
Not an Apple.
No. I'm thinking about that now, too.
Oh, by all means, do. I'm just
really
Apple,
thinking so. About that. Yeah. I'm getting a little fed up with my
PC. What do you use it for?
I still do. I spoke to you earlier about this Tire Iron Club, and I was on the executive, I still am. No, I'm not. I just retired this year out of that job. But I was on that as secretary treasurer, and of course we had a lot of emailing to do to various places and everything, you know. And then we have an RV club that the wife and I are both on the executive of that, and that involves setting up. We have a group that with our trailers, away we go, you know, various places, we're called Wagon Masters, and we set up the trips to wherever we go, my wife and I. And
yeah, we should get on the record that we're talking about Airstream trailers. And, of course,
we're the only Airstream.
Yeah, we're the only ones that got an Airstream.
Oh, so these are groups that
of our group, just with trailers.
RVers, using whatever.
Yeah, whatever they have, yeah.
I was thinking, though, that you probably do get to Airstream gatherings.
No, we never. We never went. For them.
They want too much money to join their clubs.
It's just something we never did do, and we have our own club here, you know, and just a great mix of people.
An Airstream club or an RV club?
RV club.
An RV club. Sure. Yeah.
Doesn't matter what year. In Thunder Bay.
Three.
I don't know if it was three.
There
just
used
two
to
them.
Be three Airstreams in town. Yeah. Used to be.
What's the name across the way has one? And there's mine. We run across ours during an election. The wife was, what were you doing?
I was the
enumerator or something or other.
The chief or whatever.
And she talked to another woman. They got talking about trailers. And
this was February.
In February,
yes.
And she said, we got an Airstream at home. Yeah. We had to have a look at that.
Right.
I phoned him at work. I phoned him at home, and I says, people here have got an Airstream. Never seen the inside of one, but we want our Airstream. So
right.
That was it. February, you're talking camping.
Well, we were talking about, were we talking about vivid memory? No, we weren't. I should ask you, what are your most vivid memories about your job?
You know, one memory, I was thinking about that last night, is all my kids and neighborhood kids, I'd take them over to the shop and let them run a locomotive. You know, you get a 10-year-old kid or whatever, you know, and fell down.
No, don't worry about it.
And I'd take them over to the shop and get them on our locomotive on the shop track and let them actually run the locomotive, you know, sit them on my lap and let them actually run the locomotive.
Move it,
yeah. Take the brakes off, open the throttle.
Oh, boy.
Ring the bell, blow the horn.
And the feeling of power that little guy or girl would have.
Kids 40 years old and they still remember Grandpa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Uncle Don taking them.
I can well imagine.
Yeah, I enjoyed that, you know, that I was allowed to do that, you know. Of course, you wouldn't dare do that nowadays. We have insurance problems and everything else, you know.
We have become a frightened society and lost a great deal in the process.
Have we ever?
Yeah, we'll see. Are there other vivid memories?
Well, there are memories of incidents
people.
That have. Yeah, well, you know, we built the CN Hall out here across the swing bridge. There belongs to the natives now, but we built that back in '72, I believe it was, CN Recreation Association, and we built that, and we'd have great. Parties going on there, you know, occasions, and that was, and everybody, every railroader was involved with that.
So this was one of CNCP,
CN, Canadian National,
but all the different kinds of
all the
trades,
all the trades, all the people, you know, from any CN or CN employee was more than welcome. He joined the club, you know, and we run that for many years, and then finally, well, due to the government, they gave it all to the Indians now.
Right. Well, of course, it was originally taken from them.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
But anyways, that was a good time.
Did they compensate you or give you?
No.
So you just lost it.
We lost. But then
the
railroad paid all the taxes on it,
yeah.
as all the time we were using it, and the railroad supplied 90% of the building supplies. You know, when we built it, you know, so.
Sure.
We didn't have any debt at all.
You didn't build it on company time, I don't suppose. Or...
Well, come on. It's a railroader. Of course it was built on company time.
Right. Got the picture.
Yes.
Coffee breaks.
Your wife was encouraging you to remember something earlier, and I cut her off at that point. What was it?
What was that one?
Oh, that was when you used to go up to
the Ordock.
The Ordock in the middle of winter when it was so freezing cold and everything was frozen up there.
We used to go up there and do maintenance. We'd go up there in January and get all the chutes. Those were the big chutes that came down to load the iron ore onto the boats.
Ships.
And we'd have to go up there and do the maintenance on them to make sure all the winches were working right. And that was, like she said, it didn't matter the weather. You went up there and you had to get this all done before the first ship come in.
Yeah.
And there was 200 chutes to maintain, you know, and no safety devices up there at all, you know. You walk on a walkway this wide, and then there was a drop down in a great big size of this room hole where they drop the yarn, the trains would come up, you'd drop them in there, you know. And then you'd do that all in the wintertime. And I did that just for 1 year, but that was enough of that.
I can well imagine. You wouldn't volunteer for it.
No,
her.
I wouldn't do that. At the time, it was good because it got me onto a day job. And this was one way. I figured by the time I finish this winter at this, spring's going to come, and this next guy on the day shift is going to retire, the next older guy. And I was next to get on to the day shift. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'll do that this for now, and then come summer, I'll have a nice day job. And that's the way it worked out.
Because you had been working, what, night shift earlier?
Oh, yeah, I worked a swing shift from three afternoons and two day shifts. I did that for a dozen years anyways, you know.
Yeah.
I worked 40. I didn't work much midnight, so.
No.
Were there people who worked just midnight?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you got used
preferred,
to it.
Preferred. They wouldn't take day jobs or anything.
But
preferred.
There wasn't any swinging where you'd, you know, a son-in-law works at Abitibi. Sorry, he's out at OPG, the generating station now, and he'll be on 3 days and then a day or two off, and then he's nice and so on and so forth. That kind of stuff.
No,
must
we
be
had
tough
pretty
on
well
the
fixed
body.
Shifts, you know.
Yeah.
I, like I said, a couple of guys work midnights, and everybody thinks you're nuts. How come you work at midnight? But they just done it for so many years.
Got used to it.
That's the way they lived, you know.
Yeah. When they got rested enough to do something, they had the daylight to enjoy, I suppose, would be part of the rationale for it.
But, There were things that went on the shop track. You know, there were accidents that you remember. And
do you want to tell us about one or two of the accidents that happened?
I can remember one. But yeah, there was that too. That was a bad accident there. We had a crane, a mobile crane. And they were, actually what the crane did, was we were unloading traction motors out of a flat car onto the ground, or onto the rail rather. And we had this mobile crane, was lifting them up and swinging them over. And this mobile crane, we had it situated on the edge of the turntable. And they didn't block it right. And the operators and his guys, They lifted one motor up. My friend, my good, very good friend of mine, standing beside the crane, and they swung it over, and the crane flopped right over on his side on the turntable, pinned him underneath it. And we were, I don't know how many hours before we had to get, Twin City Harbors, or have big cranes.
Right.
Not Twin City Harbor, I forget what it's called now. But they had to get their rigs out there to lift this crane up and to get him off. And that was a bad situation. Bobby still got, you know, bad.
He survived it.
Oh, yeah, he did. Survive it, yeah.
And, we don't know how. We got pictures and everything.
And he went after the railroad, and he got nothing from the railroad. They just kind of backed right away from it. They just wouldn't accept. They slapped the operator's hands and said, you shouldn't have done that, you know.
Yeah.
But that was bad, you know. It was really a bad incident that happened. And I was there at the time, and you've got your best friend there pinned under this machine, yeah. And you can't do nothing.
It was too heavy to move.
There was a couple of things we wanted to do to relieve the pressure off of his leg, but we couldn't do that because the machine was on its side and was leaking fuel. So you couldn't light a torch up and just cut it.
Right.
You just had to wait.
And there's no way you could get a jack under it.
No, no. There was no.
And it was the pressure on his chest and everything that the doctor that came, they had to move the crane up or whatever, like millimeters at a time to relieve the pressure on him.
It's amazing what people can survive. This farmer I was interviewing in Manitoba had a tractor run over his chest. And when he said that, I could see there was a certain amount of misshape to his chest, but he survived that. I marvel too at what people can.
There was one other funny. I always remember this funniness. And when you're moving a locomotive down a track and you got a side track over here and a crossover track to move over to that other track. Well, what you usually do is you have your helper. The engineer has a helper, what's called a hostler. And this helper would stop the train, and he would jump off, turn the switch, and then you'd cross over. this guy, I don't know what he was thinking of, but he jumped off, and the engine was still going forward. And he jumped off, and the front truck of the engine went over the switch, and then he turned the switch under the locomotive. So the back end of it started to go over here, and the thing was actually going down two sets of tracks like that. You know?
And there's a limit to how flexible the carriage is.
Yeah, there is, but there was enough that, and actually it pulled the whole rail over towards.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, and we looked out there. Jeez, that was funny, you know. And this poor guy, he thought, "I'm done. I've just lost my job." Yeah.
But he survived.
Oh yeah.
Was a lot of attention paid to health and safety in earlier years? No. Or?
It really came in the probably the 70s when all this WMIS program came in and all that kind of stuff. And then they started to really bear down on health and safety on the railroad, you know, and that was a good thing. Like, first things, everybody had to wear hard hats and all that. And there was a lot of... most of the employees didn't want to do that, you know. Like, I enjoyed a hard hat because I used to bump my head on the locomotive all the time underneath, you know.
Yeah.
But they were. I always wore mine. I thought it was pretty good. But a lot of guys, and you know, they come, they threaten them to fire them and everything if you don't wear your hard hat. I never heard of anybody ever getting fired over it, but they would sure threaten you, you know.
Well, it's changing the work culture.
Yeah.
It takes a while, I'm sure. And there are always blockheads around who don't think they need to do it.
But then it got real good. And I used to think they'd waste a lot of money on this health and safety because they'd take me and the boss and maybe somebody else and fly us to Winnipeg for a one-day meeting and then fly you back home. And what did we do? We didn't accomplish anything, you know.
Due diligence.
Yeah, due diligence, that's right, yeah. And then towards the end there, I thought they were slipping quite a bit. Health and safety was starting to slip quite a bit, you know.
Well, that's
less employees, you know.
More and more automation, more and more central control, and so on and so forth, so there aren't bodies to worry about.
That's right, and, you know, the guys would get away with a lot more. There wasn't the management was less as far as the car department had a locomotive foreman, they had shop foreman. Then the rip track, they had the same thing. And then in later years, there was one boss, never came over to either the rip track or the, he worked out of the yard office, you know. And
had no idea
what was going on.
Were you active in your union at all?
Not really. I was a union member, yeah. I never took...
But not on the executive or anything like that.
I run for shop steward one time, and I figured I had a couple of votes, and, you know, I probably had a fair chance. I ended up with getting one vote, and that was my own. That was the end of it.
Why do you think the winner got the support? Any ideas?
Well, the guy that got the job, he was pretty good, you know. He was, he could yell at the boss, and he did, you know. He was pretty good.
Of course, the joy of being a shop steward is that you had the right to yell at the boss.
Oh, yeah.
Do it and get away with it, not get fired.
That's right. Yeah. But no, I never run for office.
Would you have any thoughts about either the, you know, the role of the union, effectiveness, or management, labor, industrial relations, shall we say? Any thoughts about industrial relations at CN?
Well, as far as union go, that was the best thing that ever happened to the railroad. We didn't get big raises, you know. We were getting, which we didn't like about it, is if everybody got a 5% raise and an engineer is making $20,000 a year and I'm making $10,000. Who's getting the best rate here? Yeah. Eh?
And of course, Parliament would end up doing that. The arbitrator or whoever is put in charge
dictate
would just
percentages.
Do these percentages across the board.
And we didn't like that, but the railroad, I think, if it wasn't for the union, would have been back in the whole 1918 years,
Or earlier, because actually in 1918, I think there was centralized bargaining for all the railways in Canada. Of course, it was the war, so that allowed some opportunities. Back to the 19th century. Or a 1919 Winnipeg strike, you might have in mind. Of course, the Winnipeg shut down, but the trains never stopped.
Yeah, well, we had a few instances out here, a couple of strikers running crews that go to work, or try to go to work. And there were some hard feelings, way. Occasionally, not too much, though.
No.
But
it was the problem. There was never, other than this 1918 attempt, I suspect, to have common table negotiations with all the unions together.
Oh, no. No, not the time that I don't know what goes on nowadays, you know.
But through those
years. The unions now, I think the shop staff unions are CAW now.
Yeah, they may well be.
Yeah, and the IAM is out. And,
Well, vivid memories about your job. You've given us a few. Where are we here? Adjustment? No. Maybe you better just tell me.
25 minutes.
25. Oh, I don't think we'll need that. Looking at my questionnaire here. What were the most important events that happened in your workplace? Do you think you've covered those, or are there?
Oh yeah, the switch over to the computer was the biggest thing that happened to me.
Do you know Roy Lamour at all?
I know of him.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he was the first one we interviewed, actually, as it happens.
He
worked for CP.
Yeah.
R, of course, and he was involved in the designating of cars, or grade cars, to as far as the elevators they were sent to and so on and so forth. But he talked about computerization in the early 70s coming in there. And were there 30 people working in that room? And when they were finished with the computerization, there were maybe three or four or whatever. Just incredible drop.
Well, how many are left on the railroad now, Don? Not too many.
There's no yard office staff or virtually.
No, I mean
enough.
Across the country.
Oh, I don't know. I know when I started the railroad, there was 120,000 employees.
Yeah. I mean, this was an organization to make waves
with,
to move freight.
I have a, I don't know if you're still in interviewing anyone else, but I have a Howard Mackey's number, if you want to call. He worked in the yard office, and he would be.
We'll add him to the list.
Add him to the
list. Interested in talking. Do you think it's important to preserve and share the the questionnaire, of course, is grain trade history, but your experiences?
Because this, it won't be long now that Niebing shops will be forgotten.
Yeah.
Well, just, you know, nobody'll remember, oh, was there a shop there? Was, you know, like, how many people remember or even knew about the roundhouse down on Mission? How did the, on the reservation out there? There was a roundhouse out there in 1925 when they moved it from there to Niebing.
Oh,
1925,
yeah.
There was a roundhouse down there.
A roundhouse usually leaves remains behind because there's a fair amount of concrete in one, I suppose, is there?
Yeah, there is, but...
Or does that get blasted and taken up as well?
No, not if you're...
So if there's a roundhouse, usually you could find the site.
You could probably find...
And see the evidence.
I'm sure over here that the cement foundations and that are still there. I haven't been over there to look.
But the steel all went to a scrap.
Oh, everything. Those roundhouses were made out of BC fir, 16-inch timbers, beautiful lumber, and worth a fortune.
And what happened to
it? Oh, the guy that bid on the destructing, you know, tearing it down, demolition. He got all the lumber. And he took that apart very carefully.
Oh, I see. He knew what he was getting.
Oh, yeah. Okay, he knew exactly what he was getting. Oh, yeah. And that ended, I think it was in 91 when they finally tore down the last wall. And it looked like such a barren space, you know.
Right.
It was gone. And yet, ask people today and they don't even know what Niebing was.
You know? You have pictures of that, you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
Of
I took a lot of pictures of it as it is. And then I sent them into Railroad Museum down east. And
where is the museum that you were
touching? This one was in Ottawa. Or Montreal, rather.
Not Ottawa,
in Montreal. And I can't think of the guy's name.
They have some... He wasn't a McCabe, I
think. No. Can't think of it.
Yeah. Well, if you turn it up, give me a call, let me know. Let me see, what aspects of the history do you feel we should concentrate on preserving? I guess these parts of the railway business.
We tried, just the local employees here, roundhouse employees, like when we knew that the roundhouse was going to be torn down, one year prior to that, they spent over $100,000 in repairing the roof in this roundhouse. You know, I mean, you just spent. You're talking about money, and we tried to see if we could get it designated as a museum
heritage
thing, and it didn't go nowhere. You know, it didn't work out.
Well, it took $100,000 to repair the roof. It'd take a certain number of thousand to keep it up, and so.
But then we thought if we could keep it up as a museum,
sure.
You know,
but there are artifacts.
There was no doubt that it was coming down, and that was it. You know?
For sure. Are there any questions that we might have asked that you could provide now, and I'll ask them? Anything we didn't ask about that comes to mind?
Well, that'd be covered pretty good, you know. But my aspect, as far as railroad,
yeah, well, that's the intention.
I moved up to Sulicote, and to me, that was like a brand new railroad, you know. I just finished my apprenticeship, and I went up to Sulicote, and I thought, well, I know everything there is to know about locomotives, until I went up there, and I found out that a passenger train comes through there twice a day, and it stopped there for 15 minutes, and if you got a problem, you had better have it fixed. You had better, and then I found, I didn't know about that. I didn't know if you get it done and get going, because if you don't, delay this train, you know. And I learned a lot about railroading in a hurry up there, you know, like main line service, you know.
Sure.
And that was, I just didn't believe how little I did know, you know, about railroading at that time. But then you learned.
Sure.
You learned.
Well, it does.
That's for sure.
It's always.
But other than that, yeah, I figure I covered pretty much.
Great. Well, there are the last couple of questions about memorabilia and other persons to interview, which we don't have to put on the tape, I don't think. So let me wrap up, Mr. McKay. Don, you've done a great job. I'm very grateful that you deigned to give us this time after having thought it was great trade stuff.
I certainly didn't think we'd be going into in this detail. I had no idea what you were going
to do. Of course not.
I talked to...
We're going to wrap it up. Thanks very much. Push the button and we can flip this over to add names to the list. Howard Mackey, you were saying.
Yeah, I'll give...